Okay, Shavuot Tov, Gedvach. Thank you all for coming, being here this evening as we continue our annual BRS community conversation. We've done a number of these, and we're never exactly sure what's going to happen, but so far they've been very successful and really stimulating and provoking a lot of really interesting conversation and follow-up, very meaningful. And I want to thank Rabbi Moskowitz for putting this evening together, Matthew Hockerman, as always, for arranging all of the details. Speaking of Aliyah, I want to thank John Soraski of John's Place for generously sponsoring the pizza this evening, so please make sure you let John know. You can visit John's Place Boca, John's Place Ramana, and John's Place Boca. And, please support, express our gratitude to him for this evening. Tonight we're going to have a very interesting conversation. This conversation was conceived in the middle of the summer, when obviously everything going on in Israel was at the forefront of all of our minds and the focus of all of our attention. And I think that anyone with a Jewish soul anywhere felt at least some sense of a magnetic pull to want to be connected to the Jewish people, particularly in Israel, as everything was unfolding. The Jewish nation, the Jewish people, the Jewish destiny was unfolding in real time. And wherever one lived in the world, they felt connected to what was taking place, to the events of Eretz Israel, of the modern state of Israel. And that really begs the question about struggling with Aliyah. Here we are sitting in Boca Raton, Florida, Motzei Shabbos, Slichos night, Erev Rosh Hashanah, and thank God we mentioned this morning, we've broken by far our record of membership. We're at over 750 families. People are moving to Boca, settling in Boca. There are campaigns taking place for schools to build, potentially for the shul, please God, to expand at the right time. Here we are further ingraining ourselves within Boca. Shouldn't we all be picking up and moving to Israel? Isn't that the place of Jewish destiny? Isn't that where we all belong? And so there are those who do. Every year our community celebrates those who've made Aliyah. We're very proud that Nefesh B'Nefesh, Rabbi Fast, Tony Gelbart, very much connected to Boca. Nefesh B'Nefesh began here in Boca Raton. And every year we're very proud of our families who make Aliyah. And then there are other families who are not yet ready to make Aliyah, but are struggling with Aliyah. It's in their mind, it's in their vision, it's one of their dreams, and if not yet, they're still planning. And then there's another category of people for whom Aliyah doesn't even enter the equation. They're so comfortable, life is so good, why would I want to move? Why would I want to go to Israel? So we thought it'd be interesting to have a community conversation with members of our own community about this question. Is Aliyah in our mind? Some have made Aliyah, some have made Aliyah and stayed, others haven't. What are the challenges, what are the obstacles, how we can encourage other people, is it okay, is there a role for Jewry outside of Israel as well in advancing the people of Israel's needs and agenda? These are some of the questions that we're going to talk about tonight. We're fortunate to have some wonderful panelists who have agreed to join us. The promise is to be a very entertaining evening if you know our panelists. So I want to thank, first we have Rabbi Seth Grossman. We have Nathan Zucker, we have Beverly Jacob, Mimi First. We're going to go around and begin. Please introduce yourself and just describe for a moment why you're on this panel. Hopefully you know at this point. But your relationship to Aliyah, to Israel, and tell us a little bit about yourselves and then we'll begin the conversation.
Hi. Oh, I'll do that.
Take it to my table.
Hi, my name is Seth Grossman. Many of you might recognize me, some of you wish you didn't, but I moved to Boca in 2000 as part of the COLA, for Rick Goldberg, Rick Sugarman, and a few others, and we had the opportunity to become friends and then make a life here. But Aliyah was first and foremost on my wife's mind. Her mom lives there, her brothers live there, and her sister made Aliyah 6 weeks ago. So now her entire family is living in Israel. So something that she talks about all the time. And it's something that I planned on doing if I wanted to stay married. And again, you go through different thoughts, but it worked out. And I had the opportunity to come back to Boca around once every 2 months for a week and a half or so. And I guess I have a little bit of best of both worlds. You have your friends, you have your some of the things that you get here in America, but my life and my children and my family is all in Eretz Israel, and I believe because I happened to be here on the side we had it. That was the reason I was asked to be at the panel. Perhaps I think Rory Moskowitz was hoping I might do something inappropriate. That was the other reason, but I'm not going to go there. And it's a pleasure to be here, and hopefully I can answer some of your questions, and but most importantly, Nathan's over here.
Yeah, they're expecting me to do something inappropriate. Hi, my name is Nathan Zucker. I moved to Boca in 2005. I moved to Israel when I was 12 in 1984, which is more than likely the reason why I'm on the panel. Left Israel after the army to get a degree and had every expectation of going back immediately following. Didn't happen. I stayed, worked in Ohio, moved back to New York, promptly met my wife, moved out to Boca about a year and a half later, and think about moving back every day since 1994, to my wife's chagrin. But we'll see. It'll be an interesting conversation.
Hi, Beverly Jacob. I want to thank my parents for being here. They kind of brought me up always with a very Zionistic, even though we weren't in a position to visit Israel, it's always in the forefront of our conversation. And although I never really wanted to move there, I woke up one morning and before Purim in 2012, and I turned to my husband and I said, you know, you should really try to move to Israel. And 3.5 later, we moved there. And I had a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 16-year-old. And I think that's why I'm in this path.
Thanks for living there.
And we moved
back. Hi, my name is Mary First. You say the best for last, I guess. We moved down to Boca when George Washington was making his grand. We lived in Crown Heights, which was chock full of Jews, and one day I saw an ad in the Jewish press, and it stated that there were new houses for sale in a community in Boca Raton, which was one of those far-flung, unheard of places for Jews, and it was an Orthodox shul, and I wanted to get away from all the Jews, so we moved down to Boca. There were four Shomer Shabbos people at the time, and the rest is history. Many, many years later, when Rabbi Brando was here already, I went on a mission with him to Eretz Yisrael, and there are a few of you here who went along with me. I hadn't been to Israel since my son's bar mitzvah, which was many years prior to that. When I went back to Israel, I said to myself, I belong here. I really want to live there. I came back and broached the subject with my husband, who of course said, yeah, one day. And more recently than that, after the last election, I said if we have the same election results as we did prior to this one, I am moving to Israel. And I made that very vocally, very loudly. I proclaimed that I was going to move to Israel. After the results of the election, Rabbi Goldberg very nicely called me up and said, when are you moving? So I don't think you really want to get rid of me really quickly, but Seth, you want to stay married instead of why, so I'm here. And I don't believe there are ever any coincidences. I know that the mic isn't mine for the night, but you're not getting it back so quickly. I believe that coincidence is God's way of staying anonymous. I'm in the middle of reading this book, Rebbe, which is about the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And the reason I'm not finished with it yet is because I use it as my hayom yom. I find my inspiration by reading it in little dribs and drabs. And ironically, today, I got to a portion of the book which spoke about Aliyah and the Rebbe's stance on making Aliyah. And it's a very, very short little piece that I want to read to you. I hope the light is appropriate so I can see it. This chapter speaks about the Rebbe's approach and his attitude towards Aliyah. And he writes, Telushkin writes, that the Rebbe said, I believe that we must sustain to the extent possible, every Jewish community around the world. I recognize the role of the State of Israel. I personally support Aliyah, and I've sometimes instructed families to make Aliyah, but we must just eliminate a Jewish community. So if there was ever a reaffirmation, in addition to the fact that Rabbi Goldberg, you're still here, I'm still here. Thank you.
We're going to get to that. I actually volunteered to be on the panel and have Rabbi Moskowitz moderate. But speaking of marriage and good things. Anyway, so continuing the conversation, I guess, Rabbi Grossman, tell us about the process of making Aliyah. Once upon a time, it was highly bureaucratic and difficult with Nefesh B'Nefesh. It's eased the process, although I'm sure we'll hear shortly that there are still challenges to it. But tell us a little bit about your Aliyah process. What was the... Take us from when the decision was first made to the move and some of the joy of that experience.
Sure. The decision, I guess, emanated right here in this room. I believe it was this room. Shimi Kamenetsky was making a bat mitzvah, bar mitzvah, combined. I don't know if we had a thing here. And I got a call from Rabbi Schneider. Those who've been here for long, if I remember Rabbi Schneider. And he told me that there was a house next door to him. Well, he called me Friday first. There was a house. He was building a new house, a new development, but as fast as it would be on the block. So Rabbi Schneider, so he was buying on the block, and four other friends of mine that I knew from either Yeshiva or New York or whatever, we're going to be on the same block. There were 18 houses. Do you want one? There's one left. I said, sure. He said, I never heard of Ramat Beit Shemesh, but I said, no problem. He said, all you got to do is send $5,000 to some lawyer, and the house is yours. $5,000. If I don't have to think about it, I'll do it. And I get a call on Shimi's Simcha on Sunday, and I get a call from Mr. Schneider. For those who know the Schneiders, others call her Mr. Schneider when it comes to the finances of the family. And she said to me, Gazelle, I'll show him, why do you do a listen to Avi about money? If you don't send $58,000, $500 tomorrow, you lose the house. I never in a million years would have done it. But the whole Shabbos, to use my words before, the rabbis were before, the happiness, the simcha of knowing that I had a house, I found a place, I don't have to think about it, for $5,000. You know, it was at the whole job. I didn't even tell my wife. I just said I'd do it, and then I was all stuck. I was such menuchas and nefesh that we found the place where all my friends were going to be, and it was going to be ready for 3 years. So I would do it, and because of that, I never would have done it a million years if I knew how much money I had put down. But I did it when she told me I had like 6 hours to go. I made the decision right at Shimi's bar mitzvah, and I think it was Moshe's bar mitzvah. And that was the process. So the house building process was very difficult, but mostly for my mother-in-law who lived there, she took care of that stuff. But it was a little bit easier knowing you have someone to take care of it than you were going to have a house. You have to go there and figure out where you're going to live. I wasn't going to move until the house was ready, and I had plenty of friends there. Once we got there, it was 3 years later when it was ready. We said, whenever we were ready, we'd go. And we went, and there was no electricity, there was no water in the first few days, but, and then I went, I remember we lived in my mother-in-law's house, we lived at some good friend, I think we were going to make a shidduch, and make a sister shidduch. Ezra Gross gave us this house for 2 weeks, he was going to America for a wedding, he heard that we had no electricity and no water, he said, come stay in my house so you could be in Beit Shemesh, you could go to school, we were schlepping it, it was a disaster, and I barely knew him, and he gave us a house for 2 weeks, I don't think that would happen anywhere else. And that really got us going. And then the day we moved to our house, we still didn't have electricity, but most of the house, I remember we had a dark child, so Dr. Integi came to Israel that week, and he said, can you come over? We said, sure. He didn't know we didn't have electricity, so he slept in the basement on, like, I don't know, a mattress with no electricity, no air conditioning. I mean, it was 1,000 degrees, and he was fine with it. And he saw us just in the pitch black child shivers. And then Saturday night, I said, okay, I gotta go to work. And I left my wife with no electricity or water. And by the time I got back, she took care of everything. It was great. And the actual house process was complicated, but it was nice to have when it was done and to have a lot of friends. And the actual Aliyah process, that was really, really easy. Really, they talked about it, but it really happened. I mean, I filled out all the paperwork beforehand, and I'm sure that wasn't so easy. But on the plane itself, they really took care of everything, other than the fact my name was a very difficult name for making Aliyah. My name was Seth, but in Israel they spelled it Shin Tet, and they kept on cursing every time they called my name. So, and to this day, it caused problems. I switched my name halfway through the papers.
Shin Tet.
Whatever it was, the way they pronounced it, I couldn't say in the shul or outside the shul. And they had to yell my name on the whole plane that I would get up. So halfway through, I switched my name to Shlomo. That's my Hebrew name, but I haven't run out of that. But the problem is now, every time I get a check, I can't I can't check it though because they don't trust me that I'm really Seth. They don't never heard of Seth. They only heard Shlomo on the documents. But other than that, it was pretty simple. We went on the same plane with a bunch of people from Boca. Those who remember the Shermans came with us on the same plane. The Yaakov and Rehan Green came with us on the plane. And they processed everything there. I think we went for like an hour. They went to the army thing. They looked at me and they said, keep going. And they didn't make me fill out anything. They were like, no, you're over the weight limit and whatever. That was that. And we went home. We never had to do a thing again. But it was really done. The only thing you did was you want to get money for being, making out of that. You had to go every month to get some money. So for it to get money, you go. So it really was that part, for us at least, was very simple. And I'm very thankful to have my brother help with the house and everything like that. But overall, it went relatively smoothly and it stayed pretty smooth, but I'm sure.
Beverly and Marty went with similar intentions and anticipating a similar experience. I know that it was a little bit different. I want to thank all our panelists for... It's not always easy to share your personal story publicly, but I think it helps all of us in our struggle and considerations in all the directions. It's heartwarming and inspiring to hear of a story where everything went so smoothly. Beverly, tell us why you're back here in Boca.
Well, I'd actually like to talk to his wife, who's actually living.
That's what
like,
you needed, a
every
wife.
Time he said, "Oh, and she took care of that," I just laughed. But I didn't really have a very high level of Hebrew. I didn't have any Hebrew really. My husband has what I like to call vacation Hebrew. He can get by on vacation. He likes to always start a question. He'll walk up to anybody and say, "Yesh li sheila," and he'll just talk to them about whatever. But when you actually live in a country, a foreign country, you move to Spain, and I, after 2 weeks, go by, you're not on vacation anymore. So all of that kind of stuff also, we didn't make Aliyah, but there's the whole, you have to get the apartment, and you have to make sure your kids are registered in school, and all those kinds of things. And that was very, very difficult. It was difficult to do in a foreign language. It was difficult to do. My husband actually was able to keep his job here and commute, but he wasn't able to spend very much time in Israel. It was more like he'd spend like a week and a couple of Shabbases and then he'd come here. And that was difficult for him too, because he was by himself and we were all living there.
That's what he told you, probably.
what was the question?
Challenges you ran into while you're back here.
I think the hardest thing was not really being able to speak the language and to understand what was going on. A lot of times, I like to come to shul and hear the rabbi and get inspired by his speech. And when you move to Israel, you do realize and you don't realize, everywhere you go, every ceremony, every, they call it a tekes, but every holiday, you have Yom HaZikaron, if you're not familiar. You have, every week you have speeches about bar mitzvahs. Everything is in Hebrew. And, a lot of people say, but doesn't it, everybody speaks English? And I say, yeah, everybody speaks English in their house, between their four walls to their children from America. But when you go to the school building, no one speaks English. You try to pay the school with your American check, and the secretary doesn't really know much English. That was very challenging for me. And I didn't have my husband to help me navigate that.
You should have taken Seth Wine.
So I don't know what the level of Hebrew is. It's great if you have your family. At the end of the day, if your Hebrew is good, if you have a whole bunch of differences, which my situation in particular had a lot of things against. I had teenagers. I had a husband that commuted, and I didn't speak Hebrew. Change any one of those things, I might still be there. But the best part of the whole experience was that my son is actually still there. So I came with a 16-year-old, and now he decided to stay. We came back. He graduated Israeli high school, which is no easy feat.
Where did you live when you were there?
We were in Modi'in. I know Rebecca Goldberg's sister very well. She's an amazing woman. She actually makes a magazine in English for all the English speakers, so they kind of know what's going on. The only problem is you don't really get the magazine until after everything's kind of printed out. It was helpful, though. You can try to seek out a lot of English things, but at the end of the day, you really have to commit yourself to, kind of just either learn the language or kind of just walk around in the fog. But we lived in Modi'in, which was a wonderful community. It was a lot like Boca. And again, there's a lot of English speakers, but when my kids actually went to school, they didn't hear a single word of English all day. So even though everybody speaks English, you know, you've got 200 kids in a seventh grade class, you've got five kids that maybe made Aliyah that year, and five of them all talk English to each other. They don't really know what's going on. It's difficult. But kids are resilient, and they did amazing, but it was very difficult for me.
Thank you. And you were 12 when you were older? So a lot of people, one of the considerations I think when people struggle with Aliyah is often talking about their children. It's amazing you have these conversations. No one ever says my kids are the right age for Aliyah. It seems whatever age the kids are, they're the wrong age. So maybe talk about your experience being a 12-year-old, what it was like to be uprooted, what it was like to be taken from the place that you knew, and its impact on you, and even though you're not there now, what that experience was like at that age.
My Aliyah story was very different from everyone else that's here, because I didn't choose to go. I didn't want to go. When I was told, we're moving to Israel. I grew up in a staunchly Zionistic house. It was Israel, Israel, Israel from birth. You know, my dream when I was 3 or 4 was to be a pilot in the Israeli Air Force. It didn't start that early. And when we were told, I was in fifth grade, that we're moving to Israel, we bought a house, we're moving in a year. So my dad vanishes. He goes to Israel to renovate this house. We had an old Arab house that had one light bulb, and anything more than the one light bulb would have shorted out the whole house. It was in one of the first communities outside the old city wall. It was a 100-year-old Arab house. So that was crazy. It was pretty cool. So my dad was gone for a year renovating, so we're stewing for a year waiting to move. And I'm like, I'm not going. My brother and I, we're not going. Yes, you are. So the day comes. We're going to Camp Snechemet, if any of you ever heard of it. And we get driven to the airport. Goodbye. Onto the airplane we go. And that was it. I can't exactly drive home, and I couldn't at the time fly myself back. So we spend the summer in an American camp in Israel. It's the second time we were in the camp, so we're surrounded by Americans. So the summer was really just, I'm in camp. And then camp ended. They go home. I don't. So my brother and I wandered. We were at the Plaza Hotel in Israel. At the time it was the Plaza. Now it's the Sheraton, I think. We walked down to our house, which is 3 blocks away from the Plaza Hotel, to look at it, because I've only seen it in pictures and in various states of construction. And I see my house for the first time ever. It's locked up. I can't get in. My brother and I hop over the wall. It was a walled-in garden. It was amazing. So we see our house for the first time ever, and it's finished, and we're like, okay. It was big relative to Israeli standards, but not nearly as big as our house in the U.S., so now that's a negative. Oh, it's such a small house. This stinks. And my father had now gone back to the U.S. to sell our house in New York. Over the summer, my brother and I are being kids and just wandering the neighborhood, getting the lay of the land. And we're in the La Rome in Baal now pool, and my brother jumps over me, breaks my nose, hits me right in the face the day before school starts, August 31st, 1984. So I'm in the hospital the first day of school with a cast on my face. And I go to school the third day with a cast on my face. Not the best way to meet friends. So, another negative. I'm the freak, I'm the weirdo, I've got 2 black eyes and a broken nose. So for the first year and a half, really, I was angry at the universe. Very angry at my parents, didn't want to be in Israel. This is awful, awful, awful. And then I connect to visit New York. Go back to my old school, see all my old friends. I'm the outsider. All of a sudden, I'm the outsider. And they're all, you know, the snobbiness level, if you know the 5 towns. As an outsider looking in, I realized, wow, you guys are such losers. Mm-hmm. All you care about is, you know, the shoes, the shirt, and these are 13-year-olds. So we go back to Israel, and it was like, not so bad. So over the course of that next, you know, 6 months, now 2 years in Israel, my bar mitzvah already happened, it was like, wow, I could go on a bus, I can go where I want, I can go to anywhere I want, alone, and no one bats an eyelash. I got freedom, this is great. I had new friends. In my first year in Israel, I had 2 English speakers in my class. Touch on me, here's it. But that third day of school, my first, when I walk in with the cast and black eyes, kids came up to me and said, in very broken English, do you want me to sit next to you? Because desks in Israel are 2 people. And I was like, okay. It ends up that one of the English speakers was put next to me on purpose. 3 weeks later, I'm out of school in an Olpan for 3 months. And I went to Israel with functional Hebrew. I went to a summer camp called Masad, if any of you have ever heard of it. And knew Hebrew. Not good enough to learn, but I knew Hebrew. My mother spoke very good Hebrew. She went to Flatbush. And my father had very bad Hebrew. Non-functional, davening Hebrew, that was it. So, to get back to the original question, what, you know, a good age to move? 12, 13? Not a good age to move. My brother was 13 going on 14. So you're starting to become social at that age. It was like, oh, girls. And to be written, you know, your guy friends are now your core, you know, group of friends. And I was ripped away from that. And that to me was the hard part. I wasn't leaving my house and my school, because school, who cares? But my friends I was really close with. So that was difficult, being yanked away from that. But making the new friends, and in Israel they really did. You know, the kids in my class, many of them, not all, really did try to befriend me. I was the new kid, I was the freak with the white face. But there, you know, so that was nice. It wasn't like, you know, you're sitting in the corner of the class and no one goes near you. It wasn't easy. There was a language barrier. And not wanting to be there didn't help, because I guess that transfer, you know, kids are very perceptive and they pick up on it. But once I got over the anger at my parents for yanking me away, and I really got to stop and take a step back and realize I've got freedom, Israel's fun, everything's kosher, because at the time in Jerusalem you did not find a treif restaurant anywhere. It was like, wow, this place is awesome. You know, my father and I would walk Friday nights to the Kotel. How cool is that? So, did I miss New York? Yes. Do I miss New York right now? Yeah. But was I happy to be in Israel? Yes. You know, my parents, when we moved, did not officially make Aliyah. They became permanent residents so that my brother and I wouldn't be pigeonholed into getting drafted. So that was a decision I made, and when I made it, then my mother became a citizen. But it's the younger you are, the easier it will be for your kids, because they will pick up the language instantly. You know, the Bernsteins just moved. Their kids, all of them, within 6 months will speak like Israelis. It's fascinating. You know, Ari, maybe not so fast. But the kids...
But Ari went to Flatbush.
He does speak very good Hebrew.
He went to Flatbush.
He did.
And you did.
But the kids are remarkably resilient. The younger you are, the easier it will be. And when I moved, also think about it. No internet, no email. Mm-hmm. A minute to call a friend would have cost over $1. No Skype, no nothing. So I had to maintain friendships by writing letters. Nobody writes letters anymore. And even then it was difficult. You know, the fact that my oldest and closest friend on the planet is in shul here, and that we're still friends, is a testament to just the strength of our friendship. We did not write 50,000 letters back anymore. But now it's a very different ball of wax. Now it's, you know, you can talk to anyone, anywhere, at any time for free. So that's a huge easing of the burden. Now there's 50 million TV channels. I had 2. One of which was Arabic all day long. Not so easy. So when I moved, it was just much more difficult on a day-to-day basis. It's much easier now. Emotionally, you're tearing them away from their friends. It's that simple. but it's easier to overcome. They're much more resilient than we are. You just got to give them a little credit.
Okay, so we heard a smooth Aliyah story in Rabbi Grossman. Because of Esther, everything went so great. Though it was a little bit more challenging. Nathan told us what it was like to be taken there as a teenager. And I guess the question for you, first of all, I just want to remind everyone we're a 501c3, nonprofit, nonpartisan organization. We have no political opinions, and tonight's going to be about Israel, not about politics. But that said, you described this yearning, this feeling of wanting to go, and yet you're here, and you pointed out that I'm here. And by definition, if you're in the audience live tonight, you're here. Why are we here? What are the obstacles to making Aliyah? If it's a dream, and if it's a dream which can be a reality, if we open a Tanakh and we study the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, and we're bewildered, we're absolutely perplexed, how could it be? God opened the doors and the Jews didn't go back, and yet when history will be written reflecting our time, the Holocaust followed by the miracle of the modern state of Israel, and it's almost as if the messages that are being sent around the world, the rise of anti-Semitism, is kibbutz galios is being forced upon us. If we're not going to choose it, then it will be chosen for us that we're going to be taken there. And despite all the messages, here we are sitting here in Boca. So what are the obstacles? What are the challenges? What's in our way? What's the hump that we have to overcome? And are they legitimate? What's really blocking our way?
I can ask you to answer that question.
I know you can.
You would have a far better answer than I would. I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know why I'm still here. I know that we all belong in Eretz Yisrael. It's the only place on Gaza that's safe for us, that wants us, and that we need to be together. I believe that there is strength in numbers. I don't think that the Jewish people would be weakened by all being together. And I know that Hashem would watch out. He watches over us wherever we are. But then again, I do believe there's a purpose for every person. I don't think people make the choice of where they are, but I believe that we are exactly where Hashem wants us to be at every given moment. If anybody here will ask a question, 20 years ago, where are you going to be 20 years from now, Slichus night? Nobody lived after a poker. Nobody here. Not you, Rabbi Goldberg, not you, Beverly. None of us. So that every one of us finds ourselves, it's not for chance, it's Hashem's plan. So the fact that I'm still here now is part of Hashem's plan. I put everything on God's shoulders. He's got very good places and He carries everything. So I believe that I'm here for a purpose. I don't know what that purpose is. I don't know why you asked me to sit on this panel. I'm still trying to figure it out, but then again, looking at the rest of the panel, I make you all look good. So that's the purpose. So I thank you very much. I did not attend tonight. I don't know. Having been given the microphone again, it's very hard for me to relinquish it. I had an uncle once who was a Mekubal in Montreal, Canada. His name was Rabbi Greenwald. He was recognized and really known to be a big tzaddik. And I remember calling him up Erev Rosh Hashanah, asking him for a bracha. And he said, I'll give you the bracha, but I want you to know that every Jew, man or woman, has the same kayach to give a bracha. So I want to take this opportunity, being a bas kohen, I want to wish you, Rabbi Goldberg, the kayach that you need to continue your monumental task of being a rabbi of what is a seemingly easy community. And it should be easy for you. And I want to wish Klal Yisrael and every one of you here, Aksiv Vachsim Atav, should take the year of our true redemption. Seth, I wish you all the mazel in the whole world. I hope that Esther is the continuing force of making life beautiful and easy for you. And you, I wish you an Esther, and I don't know what you have, so I just wish you everything good. I good you bench here, everybody, and thank you.
That's wishful thinking from Mimi that the panel's over, but we're going to continue nonetheless.
That's okay.
If he wants to go back.
Me?
Desperate. Nathan wants to go back. Yeah, no question. But so I want to ask another question. Anyone can answer it. Which is, there are legitimate and illegitimate reasons why people have not yet made Aliyah. And everyone has to make, as Mimi just said, everyone has to make the decision for themselves. And there's all kinds of variables in that decision, right? There's family, people have family obligations. There's children. It's a remarkable thing. There are people who would be less religious if they moved to Israel than if they stayed in the community that we're at. In fact, in our community, we have a few stories of people who were born and lived in Israel, Israelis who made Yerida, who were absolutely secular in Israel and only discovered religion outside of Israel. So there is a plan for everybody which is separate. There are children from, if you bring them to Israel, and maybe, you know, Rabbi Grossman can speak about this a little bit, but when you get to Israel, you are pigeonholed to a certain degree. You're choosing a track. Are you in the Haredi, the Chardal, the Dati Leumi? What school are they going into? Are they on the way to going into the army, not going into the army? You have to make much more rigid choices than you do here in America. And those choices, if the children are the wrong age, can backfire. So there are legitimate reasons. There's no legitimate reason not to struggle with Aliyah, but there are legitimate reasons not yet to make Aliyah. Do all of us have legitimate reasons? That's a good question. That's for us to decide. But my next question, and anyone can answer, is there a role for Jews who have not yet made Aliyah for Israel? In other words, is there work that we can be doing for Israel outside of Israel? Is there work we can be doing to advance the Jewish people even without yet living in Israel? It's not as sacred, it's not as holy as serving in the IDF, as inhabiting the land, settling the land, driving the Israeli economy. I think it pales in comparison to what we do outside of Israel, but yet, is there a role to play, a quasi-Aliyah? Is there a contribution to Aliyah? Is there a role to play to support Israel even if we're not yet living there?
I don't know if this is really a role, but if you're really struggling with making Aliyah, and you say there's legitimate reasons not to go, then at least you should recognize that you shouldn't put your children in the same situation. So for me, I struggled with the language and with the Hebrew. And I just wish that, you know, as a community, if everyone thinks they're so pro-Zionist and they send their kids to Israel for summer vacations, which is all great, there should really be a focus on learning the language better. That there should be, when there were Shlifim here and there were Benot Sheirut, there was four girls and there was three families. That was amazing. We made connections with the Sneers, who we're still in touch with and we were in touch with in Israel. And then you get that connection and they learn the Hebrew in those grades that, when I say Flatbush, when you ask 9 out of 10 people in Israel, and you'll say, you're successful, not successful. And there are people that come back, people that are still there, but they're struggling. Are they working in the country? Do they have to still come to America? 9 times out of 10, the successful people, one of those people will have been in Flatbush or Shalamet. And I don't even think those people realize how high level their Hebrew is. That as a community, you need to, not even as a community, if you're struggling with, do you want your children to go, you should be supportive. When they want to stay a second year, don't tell them to come back and finish college and think about it and go after. Because then you're putting them in the same situation that you are in. If you struggle with it because you have children and they're all the wrong ages, but if your kid wants to go, and they're 18 and they're 19, they want to join the army, they want to stay a second year. That's what I'm trying to do for my children, so that they will have that familiarity, so if they go back, they'll have the language, they'll have the, there's even a cultural shock. They'll have been in contact, am I right? There's a culture shock that they'll already have been in contact with Israelis. They'll get it, they'll get them, they'll get the language, they'll get the pace of the life. And then when they want to go to Israel, it might be easier for them, even with Nefesh B'Nefesh makes it easy paperwork-wise. It really is a whole other avenue you can take. So I see parents, and, no, don't, wait, and you just support your kids, support them. It'll be hard, they're going to be in another country, and I know you want to meet your grandchildren, you want them to grow up next to you, but then you're just putting them in the same situation.
That's actually a great answer. There's some great points there. And I remember the Bernsteins of the last few years before they met Aliyah, so I believe and admit that I was a little bit cynical towards Ari, but he would always speak to his little kids in Hebrew, and always spoke to them in Hebrew around the house. And he was right, because ultimately, though they hadn't shared their plans, they were making Aliyah, and by empowering their children at a young age, they were giving them an advantage when they would finally make that Aliyah. But it's a great point, is that even outside of Israel, if we don't want our children to have the struggle with making Aliyah that we do, that we should position them for success at a young age so that they'll be able to make it and encourage it rather than seem disappointed or put more obstacles in their way.
I'm
was going to touch on the same thing. The on the original question, what can we do outside of Israel? There's the obvious. Support Israel, support Israeli causes, be Israel's champion. I'm not saying you can't disagree with Israeli policy, but you've got to be Israel's champion. We have enough enemies, we don't need more. But as far as prepping, you know, you're thinking down the road, I want to move to Israel. When we first moved here, our daughter was 4 months old. She was about to go into Hillel, I cornered Chaim Diamond, and I was like, listen, I got a real concern. Do you teach Ivris or Ivrit? And he knew right away. No, Ivrit. Because not that I had any delusions of grandeur that I'm moving to Israel in 2 years, but I wanted my kids to speak Hebrew like an Israeli, or at least sort of like an Israeli. You know, you can speak with an American accent, but speak Hebrew. And when I moved, we went to the summer camps and the Jewish day schools, but we were taught Israeli Hebrew from the get-go, so I never learned Ivris. And that actually did make the transition easier, because I had another friend who came in eighth grade who, La'asos es medaber Ivris, tortured in school, like literally mocked by the teachers, and it was bad. By the way, don't ever use the word Beit Shimush in Hebrew, in Israel. My brother did that once, and the teacher laughed at it. It was very bad. But our kids, those many of us in the room have kids in Hillel, others have kids in other schools, but all the schools are essentially pro-Israel. Hillel in particular, because my kids go there, I know, is staunchly Zionist. When you instill that in your kids at a young age, it stays with them forever. I had that from birth, waving the Israeli flag as long as I can remember. And even if you don't make Aliyah, you will forever be the champion. You'll be at the demonstrations, the pro-Israel demonstrations. If you know a friend is making Aliyah, contemplating making Aliyah, the reaction we got when we moved from my classmates was, you crazy? What the hell did you come here for? Literally, that was the reaction. You moved to Israel? Are you nuts?
Classmates in Israel?
Israel. They think you're crazy, because as far as they know, America, streets are paved with gold, and you shake a tree and coins fall out.
Get all the tours.
And, right. But, because I was brought up with such a strong, Israel is our home, Israel's where we need to be, whether you're there or not, it's home. You look back at our friends, no, don't you understand? This is where we're supposed to be. And you get the furry eyeball look, because they just don't get it. When you're there, they grew up there, they know the hardships, they didn't have that, the place for every Jew is in Israel. That's what we need to instill in our children. Because if they have that now, you may never make Aliyah, they may. But if they have that love of Israel now, they'll grow up, it'll never go away.
Seth, I've heard your Hebrew. Somebody managed with Aliyah anyway.
Ramat Beit Shemesh isn't really Israel.
It's
Poland.
But maybe you can speak to some of the dilemma that I alluded to. When you make Aliyah, I imagine one of the hardest decisions if you have children is deciding the school system to put them in, because you're making a much bigger decision than just the curriculum of that year. You're making a decision kind of on a trajectory for life. Is it that rigid? Is that just our impression? How does that weigh in on the decision of make Aliyah and the choice in terms of the schools for your kids?
It's a good question. It still was a compliment, by the way.
Thank you.
Chopped it up very slowly. In some ways it certainly is rigid. It's certainly something we've thought about. Not in our decision to make Aliyah. Our decision to make Aliyah, we're going to go. Our kids were not that old. Our oldest daughter was going to third grade, and who still was the toughest kid then when she was in America. She's still the toughest kid when she's in Israel. Not sure if it changed because we moved. But we didn't really think about that when we moved. We were going to go and figure out what school to go to. My wife did take care of the application process for school. I just made the decision of which schools they would go to. And it wasn't a decision. Our girls were a little older. They were here in America. I think it would have been, and we had a great experience in Torah Academy. We spoke Ivris. My boys still speak Ivris, and that's how their school speaks Ivris. My girls speak Ivris. My girls speak Ivris. We send our girls to a, they were really older. They were in the American culture a little bit longer. We thought that it would be a little bit difficult for them to all of a sudden go all the way to what's called Israel Haredi, but he would just call it like right wing. It would be a little bit hard in the transition. So the girls were left more of a goal called Chardal, which is they're considered, Chardal is just an acronym for Haredi Dati Lumi. You're a flag waver, but you speak of red hat, and you wear Nissan. I don't know, it's some combination there.
You're very firm, but you go to the army.
Exactly, but the girls don't. But this is, so we sent our girls to
Shirut Lumi.
Right, our girls on all like to do Shirut Lumi, and that was that, and we very much supported. Our boys go to a school where there's never been a graduation. The oldest class was 8th grade, and I think they just graduated this year. So no one really knows, but the track would certainly be most of them not go to the army. My wife definitely wants my boys to go to the army. I'm kind of indifferent on the matter. Depends if the kid's a good learner or not. Depends if the kid wants to go. But I'm kind of right here either way. But the laws changed in Israel. So the decision we made to put our boys into that school at that time was kind of saying that he would probably have to, you know, either leave most of his friends or go to a different high school. Again, in Ramat Beit Shemesh, as Nathan said, a different animal, but the biggest thing is there's more kids in schools. So the school that my kid goes to high school probably doesn't exist yet. So we don't know what's going to be in the future, but at that time we made that decision, we decided the boy would go to a more right-wing track for various reasons, mostly from our friends from the Schneiders who go there, and another friend, neither of whom are necessarily right-wing parents, but just the school, the boys' schools were better. They were just better schools, and that was really the decision why we made it. It wasn't a hashkafa decision. And but we didn't know what they were going to do. We still don't know what they're going to do. I have a feeling that my older boy's going to go to the army, and my second boy's not going to go to the army. That's my guess. Again, the law could change. My first boy talks about it like Nathan talks about he wants to be in the army. My sister came from summer, took them to this Caliber 3. He and actually my wife were enjoying shooting way too much, but my wife actually said she wanted to get a gun. That's not a good idea for my wife.
Not a good idea for you.
But I might have to start doing something around that. But it was still, once we were there, that was the thing we struggled and thought about a lot. It was not an impact. It didn't impact our decision whether to go or not. That was kind of that was a side point. And just since I don't usually speak about my wife in public, since we're a Goldberg, so I mentioned it. I will say that they're struggling to make Aliyah. I think it's twofold, and Nathan kind of made a hand motion, and it's true. The biggest struggle, I think, for most people, especially American English speakers, is making a living. And frankly, that's how I met my wife. When I was in YU in Smicha, I was working part-time in a bank which no longer exists, but it was Bankers Trust. Now it's part of Deutsche Bank. So, shocking enough, when Deutsche Bank took over Bankers Trust, they closed the Israel branch. But but I actually was sent, I went for Sukkot, specifically because a week after Sukkot, they said I could have an internship in the Israel office of Bankers Trust. And I went there, and there were a bunch of from Jews and from Teaneck, I'm sure I've seen. So the Goldbergs and the Jay Bonnerman's opened it up, and a few other people that were there. And I had an internship there, and the week that I was there, the Russian debt crisis happened, and that was kind of the bank lost $750 million while I was there, and it was sold very shortly after. But while I was there struggling, I did that specifically, so maybe, yeah, I was thinking about it, but maybe I could one day make out that, but I wouldn't do it without a responsible way to make a living, and it didn't work out. But I met my wife on a bus while I was there visiting for Sukkot. She was visiting her mother, and we were going to Maracan Machpela, and so we met this. So even the struggle, even the planning for making Aliyah, you never know what could come out of it. Sometimes it's good, and sometimes you find your wife. But either way, it kind of, you know, it was really the cause of trying to make Aliyah. And that's the last question about the Goldberg Mansion, and it's something I spoke to very fast about. I will say he's one of the busier people around, and not with energy necessarily, but a Goldberg fraction of projects. But I told him, for me, I think the best thing that Navishkin actually could do is a partnership with like the OU and the RCA, all these things that have these job things. There's so many big, large corporations that hire people from their main corporations that outsource stuff, whether it's India, whether it's this, whether it's that. They should have some kind of lobby for American companies. There are so many from, or even not from, Zionistic, wealthy, high-end managers and above, managing directors, partners, whether it's an accounting, you know, companies of the big four, or whether it's the banks or the investment banks, whether it's the actuarial firms. There's so many people that have the ability to hire people, and there's so many jobs that they don't go to the office anymore, they don't need to go to the office anymore. If there would be a push for all these, you know, top-end guys to figure out a way to hire American-speaking people, which they hire anyway, or sometimes people don't speak English, but they're supposed to be, like people that call you at 7:30 at night. But if they were to have a way to hire, they save money. They don't have to pay all the, you know, if you go to any payroll budgeting, they put in 25% on top of your salary for all the benefits. They don't have to pay that when you hire someone from Israel. They can't take it anywhere. There's so many different things they can do. They might pay a little extra taxes, but they can save money. And if there was a push somehow to employ Americans, again, or just people who not Americans, people who fit the bill for what they need, even though they don't live in America, you could. So that's the biggest challenge making out of it. Most people that I know that live there either commute, you know, thank God I have a job, to give credit, my grandma taught me a profession for which that I can do from Israel most of the time. I come just to meet people, but generally I can do the job there. There's so many jobs that you can do from far away, and we got a push to do. But the biggest challenge is finding those jobs. Even when you get to Israel, if you get a great job, you might be making $22,000. Most of us in American standard of living can't live on that. So that's, I feel, the biggest challenge. Everyone that I know is either Rebbe, which means that rich parents are in-laws, or they have someone who commutes, or if you start when you're young, if you were 20 and you went to the army and you got into the Fevra, and you know, you start in high tech and little by little you moved up, or you know, then the plan, you could be successful. But to come when you're 30, I don't care how good your Hebrew is, by the way. My Hebrew stinks, but if it was great, I wouldn't have the skills to get a job in a regular Israeli high tech company. And if I did, they'd pay me like a secretary. And we wouldn't be able to live on that salary. But there's very few jobs that you could do. Even the doctors don't get paid well, you know, it's very hard. So if we could somehow from America figure out a way to employ outsourced jobs to people living in Israel who for sure are probably going to be 90% of the time overqualified for the jobs, but the money that they'll get from that job, which will be a bargain for the American companies, will be a boon for the people living in Israel. I think that's the best thing we could do to help people making Aliyah and already people living in Israel.
That's good.
Esther has a new job. Esther has a new job.
Esther's job, she makes $4,000.
She could be the coordinator.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. Okay, some great suggestions that are coming at us. Over the summer, I made a commitment to myself with everything going on in Israel that on Facebook I was only posting messages about Israel, whether it was links to articles, whether it was questions, whether it was statements of support. So a few people who I'm friends with on Facebook will recognize this. But early on, I was trying to write some positive things, and there were some people, I don't even know who they are, but from Israel, who were writing in the comments of my posts the most aggressive, condescending, challenging, basically saying, enough talking about supporting Israel. If you don't live in Israel, basically be quiet, either move here, live here, you know, follow your words with action, or, you know, to which is kind of absurd, because would it have been better just not to post anything positive about Israel? So there is a little bit of a phenomenon that I like to call Aliyah snobs, which are the people who 10 minutes ago never considered Aliyah in a million years, but 30 seconds after making Aliyah have zero tolerance and can't understand how anyone doesn't live in Israel and spends their life talking down to those who don't. So if that's our fate lot, we probably deserve it, but it's a fascinating phenomenon. So what I'm driving at is the following question. Is it difficult? You know, I have comments. They say about the rabbi in general, an American rabbi should never talk about Aliyah. You know, kind of the old story is that rabbis don't talk about Aliyah, they'll get fired, the congregants don't want to hear about it. You all know, I hope, that I'm not afraid to talk about it, and I do talk about it. We celebrate every year at Shavuos, the families who've made Aliyah, and Israel is very much part of our speeches, the Rebbe Moskowitz, all summer while he was here, and then when I came back, and we're not afraid to constantly remind ourselves about the importance of struggling, of planning, of challenging ourselves to make Aliyah. Is it hard to hear rabbis talk about Aliyah if they haven't made it themselves? Or do you welcome the message because it continues to inspire you? Or do you wish the rabbis would be quiet? Because if you're not living in Israel, you have no right to talk about living in Israel because it's essentially hypocritical.
I don't think it's hypocritical because the rabbi's job is to be a leader. And the leader is not necessarily one that goes into battle, but rather leads a good army into battle. So I don't think that it's hypocritical. As far as what we can do as Americans to help Israel, it's a tiny little facet, but I had read an article that an Italian writer wrote about Israel, an Italian guy, an Jew. And the article that he wrote, he questioned why does the world hate Israel so much. This was during the ongoing war now during the summer. And in summation, he said that after 2,000 years of being thrown out of a gazillion countries wherever we ended up, not only do we survive against all odds, speaking about the language barrier, the culture barrier, Jews are taken and thrown into foreign and alien territory. They don't survive, they thrive. They don't only thrive, they lead. They become the cream de la creme of every society that we live in. They are again thrown out of these very societies that they helped. And again, they manage to get up and they always go on. So the world hates us. It's pure and simple envy. That was his summation. And therefore, they can't help it. It's not something that you can cure a bit by being nice to them or teaching them, because they can't help but hate us. After I finished reading that article, I felt compelled to write to him. A, because he came out at a time when Israel needed some recognition for not being the evil mamzerim that the world would like us to believe that they are. And I wrote him a letter of thanks for his article and his support of Israel. And within 2 hours, I got an answer from him. So if you'll ask Carol, he'll tell you that I'm now doing this ongoing thing, but he's much younger than I am. It's Julio Miadi. He writes in Arut Shevach, posts his articles. He's a very, very big supporter of Jews and a big supporter of Eretz Yisrael. He wrote a new, it's not new, he wrote a book about the last Holocaust. It's about the Jews in Israel that were terrorized. He writes about each of the individual terrorist acts and the aftermath. He touches on so many different things that we always thought we would never forget, but in reading them, I said, gee, I forgot about this one. I forgot about that. It used to be that in Israel, there was the bombing at Sparrow's. There was, you know, each incident had a name. They don't anymore because they're so frequent. And in this book, he reiterates every single tragedy. And I wrote to him again after I read the book. And again, he sent back a letter. It was almost like a love letter. He wrote to me that the support that he got from whoever he got support from gave him strength to continue. So I think that whenever we read an article from whether it be a Jew or a non-Jew, that we should strongly encourage and thank them for it, because it does matter. Because public relations is the one thing that we don't have. So if anybody ever writes anything that you feel is good, acknowledge it. A curse of hope besides everything else is really critical. And that's what I find that I do now. So every time I read an article that's positive about Israel, I immediately send a letter of thanks. And they're pretty good letters too, I must say. Because I mean it. No, it's not like I don't have to color it with anything, because these people are helping Eretz Israel and therefore helping us.
Can I touch on your question? I want to touch on that also.
You take it first, please.
As far as the speeches about Israel and then the posts about it, I was the same way during the war. I posted nothing that wasn't about Israel. But as far as the speeches in shul, I don't know if I'm different than anybody else, but my connection to Judaism is very tied very directly to my love of Israel. So when I'm in shul, there's a speech about Israel. It's inspiring not just for my love of Israel, but also to my connection to Judaism. So no, the speeches about Israel for me were a boost. It wasn't like your typical Parshat Shavua speech. It was more, you're a Jew, you're a proud Jew. Love Israel, don't lay down, never again. That's what I get out of those speeches. So for the naysayers, or for those that make Aliyah, and they're like, don't talk about Israel. The only time I ever say stuff like that is when they're telling me, oh, Israel should send troops to here and bomb them and blah, blah. It's like, all right, that's very cavalier of you. When it's your son or daughter carrying the rifle into the field, then tell me where to send the army. Until then, say nothing. But to support Israel or to criticize Israeli policy, that's fine. No one can begrudge you that. It's when they tell you where to send the military or what the military is doing wrong, then you're crossing the line. That's where I draw the line, personally.
Couldn't take the whole night and not take a shower and go over it, but... Right, over. As you said to me, I heard your Hebrew. And therefore, I would like to say... in a nice way. I don't feel it's hypocritical for you or other rabbis to tell people to go to Israel, even if you're not. You would not have the same mission in life as you have in Israel. I live in Israel next to other successful rabbis from America who haven't found their niche, whatever that word is, in Israel, because their town, if you're a town speaker, I'm not saying you are, I'm not saying you're not. I'm just saying if you're a talented speaker and you inspire thousands of people to support Israel, and then you go to Israel and you're going to speak in broken English, Hebrew, English, whatever they call it, and people already are in Israel, how are you inspiring? Well, how are you being successful in your life? Similarly, if it's like saying a rabbi is hypocritical, he tells the rich people in the community to give more tzedakah, but the rabbi doesn't have enough money because rabbis aren't paid enough. Again, I'm not talking about Hebrew. I'm just saying, wouldn't it be hypocritical for a rabbi to tell the viewer and the wealthy people of a community to give tzedakah, give more tzedakah, give $100,000 for this if the rabbi doesn't make that money to be able to give? It's not, everyone's not in the same position. So it's almost a silly question. Of course it's not hypocritical to tell people who are in the position to move to Eretz Yisrael, whether it's financially, whether it's familial, that's fancy words, we're connected to family.
That's so fancy.
Whether it's again your friend, whatever the reason if there's nothing that's legitimate holding people back, they should be told and inspired to go to Israel. That doesn't mean that for everyone they're in the same position, and it would be appropriate for them to pick up and move. Again, as you said, there are very many legitimate reasons not to go, but if those inspirations should be for those people for whom those reasons aren't applicable, they should go and they need that inspiration. I believe that when you signed your 10-year contract, you spoke about that as well. You used the same line, if I remember correctly, which there's no legitimate reason not to struggle. And also, the people who are struggling, think about, they need that push. It doesn't mean that it applies to each guy in every seat, or even the person that's speaking from the pulpit. And so that's perfectly normal for everyone to have different circumstances, and I don't see how one would find that it's hypocritical not to go. That being said, if you come, we will welcome you with open arms.
Those keeping score at home, I think that was two compliments from my girlfriend today. That's a world record for me. We have only a few minutes left. If there are any questions from the audience, I wanted to entertain questions from those who are gathered. Thoughts, questions about Aliyah? Yes, Dr. Macover. There's two sons who have made Aliyah serve in the Israeli army.
We have two sons who made Aliyah in the last few years, one about 5 years ago, one about 2 years ago. I'm curious about how the response is. One of their issues, what they noticed is that they both are fluent in Hebrew, and they found it almost impossible to break into a social circle of Israelis. And our oldest son went there with the express purpose of trying to be an Israeli and be part of Israeli culture with native Israelis, and after multiple attempts, he unfortunately realized that he really, even though he's fluent in Hebrew, is most comfortable in an Anglo culture. was wondering what your experiences were interacting socially with Israel. Did they accept you? Did they not accept you?
As a 12-year-old, no, they didn't accept me. But it's when...
25.
The way I found with my parents and with my... No matter what, the Anglos in Israel always end up, you know, in clusters. But the one place where I didn't feel that was in the army. You know, once you're in the army, you're in your unit, your unit mates become your brothers and your brothers forever. And there's no, you're an American, you're an Israeli, or whatever. That's the one place where I truly found I was an Israeli. And I have no shred of accent when I speak Hebrew. But they all know, everyone knows you're an American. It's either the way you dress, the way you brush your hair, who knows?
And your nose.
Yeah, that's the white.
They smell it on you. There's no way.
They actually don't smell it on you.
but truly, in the army, and you can ask your son, I hope they have the same experience. In the army, you're a comrade in arms, and then from that point going forward, I would assume, once he gets out, they're still his buddies, you know, and that's what truly breaks that barrier of you're an Olé, you're an American, you're not a Sabra. That's what broke it for me.
When you're our age, it's true, you're never going to feel Israeli, and I think he's right. That's the key, is to get there, not only to the army, and the question before, also when you send your kids to school, you really are setting them for life. It's also going to the army at the same time that all, you have to be the same age, the same, that really is the key. The Hebrew will come, I think even if you join the army at 18, if you were 12, you have the Hebrew ready.
You really learn Hebrew in the army.
You have to. There's no getting out of it. But yeah, the Anglos do cluster, and it's such that we're all English speakers, and it's difficult. You seek out other English speakers, but they're really British and South African and Australian, right. And you really have nothing in common because they have all the different Canada, and you really have different cultures. The only thing you have in common is that you all speak English.
But there is actually one common thread. The common thread among adults is...
You're Jewish.
Well, yes. Yeah. But they're the Israelis who, I've been here, I've suffered, I've done the army, I've done everything. You just got here. You have money. Doesn't matter if you do or you don't. They assume you do. So you've got money. It's easy for you. And there is a divide. But when the common thread you would have with the Israelis, with the Sabras is... We sat in the same foxhole. So that, you know, when you go for a job interview, one of the things they're going to ask you, what did you do in the army? You can't avoid it. So if you're 40, you're 30, and you go for a job, what did you do in the army?
I sent cupcakes.
right, yeah, I brought them care packages.
Glenn Gallis told me to say hello.
Which they appreciate, but it's still, you don't have that common core experience that every Israeli since 1948 has had, and that will separate you forever. Doesn't mean my mother never served in the army, and she's as Israeli as anyone can get, except that she speaks with an American accent 30 years after making Aliyah. But it doesn't matter. Like, she didn't serve, but she's after that many years, you're a bend by it. It doesn't matter anymore.
I'll just disagree on one thing. First of all, your kid specifically, they could have thought he was an Egyptian spy because he was living in Egypt for a couple of years.
Jordan
or one of those countries that everyone's Arabic, and I'm still scared to speak to him, actually. And I learned with him, but I'm just saying. But I think that I've been fighting this in my shul. My shul specifically is a shul that's made up of American and Israeli-born people. I'm on the board. I kind of make a lot of decisions. I fought very hard, and I won, because I usually do win these things, that the Israeli speakers, they didn't want to have any Torah, Shiurim, or anything in English. So this is Israeli shul, you move to Israel, you know, suck it up, you're in Israel. And I kind of said, no. And frankly,
that's because you're in Beit Shemesh.
You are? Uh-huh.
It's only because you're in Beit Shemesh.
No, it's because I said, I'm going to do it in my house. And I have 30 people coming every Friday night, and every Shabbos morning, we have a shiur. And now the shul realized, why in the world would I want to have these shurim in my neighborhood and not consider it part of the shul? Because frankly, if they say we're big for people to make Aliyah, and then you say, oh, but you can't speak English, so all these people wouldn't learn. I don't know how to give a shiur. I can barely give a shiur in English, but I don't know how to give a shiur in Hebrew. And certainly, people don't, like on Shavuos night, there was a whole fight, people not fighting, all right, discussion. People didn't want to have English, but if it's in Hebrew, so everyone's either sleeping or not there, because they don't understand, it's not the time to do Ulpan, Shavuos night, 3 o'clock. It's ridiculous. So I ran the show, and we alternated, and even the Hebrew speakers I got were only... We're very easy Hebrew speakers as opposed to the people, usually the Americans who made Aliyah afterwards try to have a much harder Hebrew actually than the native Hebrew speakers. But the biggest thing that I said of all this stuff is that the bottom line is I am Israeli. I moved to Israel. I live in Israel. Well, I don't really pay taxes yet, but I will one day. I have a 10-year exemption. But I am Israeli. It's not. I don't have to try to fit into being. I am Israeli. I live my life the way. I don't speak Hebrew at all. I don't feel bad about it at all. My wife wants my kids to get more integrated. I want my kids to be happy. I don't care if they're integrated, not integrated. We have a whole beautiful community of Israelis. My shul is known to be the shul where there's Israelis and Americans. But at the end of the day, I said, we're all Israeli. And the rabbi has kind of backed me. The rabbi happens to be a tzaddik, but he backed me up. He said, there's no such thing. We're all people who live here, right? I know this from something, but I saw Yeshiva Noam did it, but I'm for sure from someone. They go to all they do. I am Noam, or I am. I think it's commercial. I am Nike. I don't know, one of these things. And that's basically this, I am Israeli, and you're Israel. You move to Israel, you go and you uproot your life. It's like they say, "Bakum shabali tshuva omdim." Ain't you know? Ain't tzadik gemur yochol lamud b'hem. If you were born in Israel, like Nathan said, he had no choice to move to Israel. They were born there. I changed my whole life. I uprooted my life. I left my friends, my family. I was telling Rabbi Moskowitz, was it Rabbi Moskowitz before? Someone asked me, Rosh Hashanah, was that you? Well, like, I used to be the guy, but I used to choose against who gets, what's it called? I'm after Yona in the shul. And now I sit in the corner. I'm lucky if I get psicha. You know, you were somebody, and it's hard. Now I'm a somebody again over the years. Thank God I became a somebody. But like Nathan said, they think you have money because you're from America and works out. But at the end of the day, you are Israeli, and you struggle, and you gave up everything to go there. You can't let someone, no one can tell you that you're not Israeli. You're right. You didn't fight in the army.
It's true.
And work-wise, that is complicated if you're younger. Again, they might understand it, but I'm not skilled to get a job there. But outside of that, no one can tell you you're not Israeli. If you go there and I'm not embarrassed by Hebrew. Sometimes I say embarrassing things, but I'm not embarrassed by the fact that I didn't learn Hebrew well. But again, that's what Esther yells at the electrician and the phone company, all that stuff. But you are. Don't let your son is Israeli, and if he's more comfortable hanging out with his American friends, call a kavod to all those kids who ended up moving there. And great, and that they have every right to hang out with whomever they want, and they shouldn't feel second class. They're first class, and for frankly, they should be more proud that they chose to do those things, and he shouldn't feel at all, second class because he did that. So I think it's just a mentality change.
One more thing, as far as what Seth said, while they still look at you like you rode it on a unicorn because you left America to move to Israel, they admire you for that. They still look at you like you're crazy, but they admire you.
On that note, I want to thank our panelists for joining us this evening for this wonderful conversation. I think there's a lot more until we all make Aliyah. We should continue to struggle with it. We can go on visits and tours and missions. I believe the Ministry of Tourism in Israel is sending us things to give out on Rosh Hashanah. During the war this summer, tourism was way, way, way down. So they're actually sending pledge cards to shuls across America asking people to pledge that they're going to visit Israel this year. They're going to spend their dollars, visit, tour. And that's the beginning of Aliyah, is taking those Daladamo steps, is walking in Israel, is figuring out, spending summer, sending children, going on missions, going for sukkahs, obviously within all the financial, I'm working on getting the evangelicals to pay for us to go on missions to Israel. We want to go, they've got the money, whatever reason they want us to be there, it's none of our business, but maybe we can get them to fund our trips to Israel. But I want to thank everyone, I want to thank all the panelists for joining us this evening. We're showing a fantastic film, The Quarrel. Rabbi Moskowitz gave it 2 thumbs up. We're beginning it in 3 minutes in the Grand Sanctuary. Rabbi Rabinovich is delivering a Chabura for Men beginning in 3 minutes in the center's library. And as Andrea knows, Nathan will get the last word.
One thing. Just as the rabbi mentioned, while what we can do to support Israel, during the war, every war, I was in the army during the first Gulf War 500 years ago. The first thing Jews did and do, it's a horrifyingly bad pattern, during every conflict in Israel is they, the tourists, the kids that are there for the year, they run away. Who continues to go during war? The Christians. You want to help support Israel? Go, it's not easy. Go in times of war. Go when it's not so easy. Support them when they really need to support. That is what we can do.
Thank you all so much.